truce, although the Zionist forces in the north, I believe today, have actually broken the ceasefire and were responded to by the Qassam brigades. It's also worth noting that the humanitarian relief that is kind of trickling into Gaza is only 1/5 of requirements, even under normal circumstances, not under the absolutely horrific, horrendous circumstances that the Gazan people are now living with, and with largely the withdrawal of, for example, the UNRWA staff and officers from central and northern Gaza to southern Gaza. Euromed Monitor has made the point that effectively they're complicit with the Israeli plans to ethnically cleanse Gaza of Palestinians and to force them into the Sinai Desert, which has been the proclaimed plan by a number of Israeli government officials. So I'm less optimistic that the war is not going to start again, or rather I wouldn't call it a war, I would call it an ethnic cleansing. Netanyahu wrote a personal piece for the Jerusalem Post 2 days ago, and it was very clear from that piece that he perceives this as some kind of course, religious, cultist war. He's been calling the Palestinians Amalek. We know what that means. It means the extermination of all Palestinians that are, of course, encapsulated as Hamas. Although we know that Hamas is not the only resistance faction that has risen up against the Zionist occupation. And that is one of the reasons, of course, that this war is being spun as Israel against Hamas, because it identifies the enemy both in Western perception and in political spheres in order to justify the continued targeting of the people of Gaza.
Exactly. The massacre of so many thousands of Palestinians, many of them children. Yusuf, you are from Gaza. You've lived there through repeated cycles of Israeli violence. Compare what happened in the past 7 weeks with all the previous ones. You reported from there, I recall. We were on air together.
Yes, indeed. I reported on the first Israeli war on Gaza, the second, 2008-2012. And those two wars that I experienced, it was a joke compared to this war. This is an all-out aggression, a war that no other wars. I think it's the worst massacre in our modern history since the Second World War. And the amount of bombs, you're talking about 1.5, the equivalent size of Hiroshima bomb dropped on Gaza.
Yeah.
Flattening,
in the span of 7 weeks. Yeah.
Entire neighborhoods were flattened to the ground. And the northern part of Gaza especially is uninhabitable now. You're talking about 1.7 million people. They become internally displaced. So this genocidal war is Israel's revenge because it suffered a heavy blow on the 7th of October. And from the first moment, Netanyahu and his army generals, they painted a picture that Gaza is a hub of terrorism and Hamas is using Gazans as human shields, and children of Gaza are children of darkness, and people support the resistance. So he decided, okay, let's carry out carpet bombing, kill everybody. I heard some Israeli officials or even commentators, they said we must kill at least 100,000 Palestinians. Mm-hmm. So Gaza is considered the capital of resistance. So when people under occupation, under siege for the past 17 years, and they decided to infiltrate the border and revenge 75 years of ethnic cleansing and suffering and atrocities.
It was a reaction to that.
It was a reaction to that. Yeah, often the Western media, they don't mention the context. Yeah. They just focus on, do you condemn Hamas and what happened? So this war is a very devastating war, and I think it will take some time to rebuild Gaza. I was in Gaza 2 months ago, 2 months before the war. I documented my trip being away from London, from Gaza, and this beauty, this nice places, it's all vanished. Israel has a goal to depopulate Gaza and ethnically link the people of Gaza.
And you have family there too, right?
To Sinai. Yes, my family is there. My parents, siblings. They suffered like the rest of the population. We were not able to communicate for over a week, sometimes for over 10 days over the course of 50 days ago. But they suffered not only because they survived, it's because every day they survived was a miracle. They had to go through this psychological impact and stress and bombardment and being starved. People cannot find now food, although they have the money.
Yeah.
Gaza is still under siege. Israel is still in full control of Gaza's airspace, territorial waters, and border crossings. Yeah. And the aid that is being trickled into Gaza is nothing. It's not going to alleviate the suffering.
Yeah, a drop in the bucket, for sure. And one of the places, or one of the many places that were bombed were UN facilities. And the UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, has welcomed the extension of the ceasefire that would have expired Monday. He called the two-day pause, quote, a glimpse of hope and humanity in the darkness of war. He also commented on the possibility of Israel opening the so-called Kerem Shalom crossing that would enable much-needed aid to enter Gaza. The UN chief also speculated on the future of Gazan leadership post-war, comments that will surely rankle some Palestinians.
It's a glimpse of hope and humanity in the middle of the darkness of war. And I strongly hope that this will enable us to increase even more the humanitarian aid to the people in Gaza that is suffering so much, knowing that even with that additional amount of time, it will be impossible to satisfy all the dramatic needs of the population in Gaza. Well, first of all, I am sincerely hopeful that it will be possible to have other crossings because they will facilitate the distribution and that will also facilitate the control by the Israeli side. So I'm very hopeful that this will happen. A Palestinian Authority, hopefully in the day after, and as I mentioned, we will need to look seriously into how the transition takes place, and obviously the before has implications on the after, and so it's still early to know exactly how things will happen. But I believe that we need a Palestinian Authority with the responsibility to rule in Gaza, in the West Bank, and to create the conditions to make sure that the two-state solution moves forward, and this time moves forward in a way that is irreversible. And so, obviously, this will naturally lead to a strengthened Palestinian Authority, and I believe the international community should be ready to support it.
Vanessa Bealey, your reaction to Mr. Guterres' comments that they want the PA to take over in Gaza and all the rest of it.
Yeah, I mean, really, that was, listening to it, I mean, it's just a huge word salad. You know, the UN appears to be completely powerless when faced with bringing to bear international law against the Zionist entity that has violated international law since its creation in 1947, effectively by the UN and before the 1948 Nakba. You know, the reality is that the UN should be, even at the beginning of this ethnic cleansing, the continuation of the 1948 and the 1967 ethnic cleansings, the UN should have actually been forcing Egypt, for example, to open the Rafah border to allow humanitarian aid to enter Gaza into the so-called safe southern areas. Of course, we know that those areas in the south are not safe because not only have the convoys evacuating civilians from the north to the south been bombed, including ambulances, but also Khan Yunis and various other, and Rafah itself has been heavily bombed and huge swathes of Khan Yunis and Rafah destroyed. So where was the UN from the 7th of October onwards when it became absolutely clear what Israel was intending to do? They were announcing what their intentions were. So where was Guterres? Where was the UN? Where was the ICJ, the ICC, all of the so-called international law structures that should, at that point, from a humanitarian perspective, have forced the opening of Rafah? So I don't, you know, when somebody is saying to me, hopefully we can persuade Israel to open the Harem Shalom crossing, yeah. I don't hold out much hope for it, because we haven't seen very much proactive pressure being put upon the Zionist entity by the UN ever, actually.
Mm-hmm. And we did see one UN official resign weeks ago, looking at the world body, the way it was working and operating vis-a-vis this eruption in violence. Yusuf, again, the Palestinian Authority taking over in Gaza, we all know that the Palestinian Authority does not enjoy popularity or the support of all Palestinians. How do you see it happening, panning out, moving forward?
Well, they already announced that they are not willing to rule Gaza at the back of an Israeli tank. But as a matter of fact, there are no military posts, there are no police stations to come and rule Gaza. I mean, Gaza needs an urgent intervention to rebuild it, to relieve almost 2 million people. There is a war of starvation. When we're talking about the UN cannot force any UN resolution. You know, the UN headquarters is based in New York, and you know the stance of the U.S. administration giving Israel a green light. It's, as Vanessa said, it's powerless. You know, they cannot force Israel to stop. The whole world was
They can enforce resolutions when it comes to Iran and Iraq, but
yeah, this
when
is
it comes to
the
Israel,
double standard policy,
not.
Of course. The Israeli genocidal war in Gaza exposed their hypocrisy. The UN should have provided humanitarian aid, but they withdrew their staff from the northern part of Gaza, despite many calls to send this aid. We know that the international community is not serious when it comes to condemn Israeli crimes. If we compare that with Ukraine, of course, we know the double standard policy. The whole world was waving the Ukrainian flags, the flags of Palestine. In some countries, they were outlawed. There is attacks on Palestinians in the United States. So this comparison shows that there is injustice going on. There is hypocrisy. The United Nations must exert its effort and show that it implement its slogans of spreading peace and putting an end to conflict, armed conflicts. The Palestinian people in Gaza are the victims of 75 years of Israeli oppression, ethnic cleansing. But as a matter of fact, people, they have steadfastness, they have high morale. Whatever Israel does, they will not leave Gaza. They will not become refugees again. The international community must pressure Israel to abide by international laws and to implement even one UN resolution.
Yeah. Speaking of, again, I'm going to stick with the UN a little bit. And Vanessa, speaking of the powerlessness of the United Nations, I wonder if they have weighed in on this. But just yesterday, I think, it was Israel, the war cabinet, so-called, announced hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, to build new settlements in the West Bank, even as we await the further extension, perhaps, of this truce.
Yeah, I mean, you know, what has been going on in the West Bank, as Yusuf described it, has been a continued trickle ethnic cleansing. We've seen the destruction of infrastructure, the destruction of connecting roads, the bombing of mosques, which is a war crime. There's no Hamas in West Bank, and yet the ongoing detentions, arrests, killings, I think up to 200 now, have been killed both by the IOF and by the what I call the ISIS settler militia operating inside the West Bank. We know from, I think it was a documentary that was made 2 years ago, The Cold Stones of Justice, where Daniela Weiss, the leader of the settlement forces, basically, explained how she used to collaborate with Ariel Sharon back in the 70s to ensure that the settlements prevented the creation of a Palestinian state at any point. And so that is what the settlements are for, this creep annexation of Palestinian territory, including, of course, the Jordan Valley, which is being targeted both by Netanyahu, who's an expansionist, revisionist, Zionist, and Smotrich, his finance minister, who even talked about this in Paris earlier this year, which will then fully encircle the West Bank again with the apartheid wall and with Israeli occupation. So the settlement project is ongoing even while Gaza is being ethnically cleansed. So it's clear that the intention is to ethnically cleanse all of Palestine. And of course, we had, I think it was the Arabic account on Twitter, or X as it's now called, with the hand holding the whole of Palestine with the Israeli flag, which was then deleted. So their intention has been very clear, even to the point where the heritage minister has talked about nuking Gaza, where various people have floated the idea of using nerve gas against the resistance and fighters also, in the tunnels.
Yeah, and also a screenshot of someone in Israel, I think someone in the higher-ups, of looking for Gaza on Google Maps and not being able to locate it, which again supports what you have been saying over the past few minutes. Thank you very much. And with those comments, we are going to wrap up this show. Many thanks again to my guests, Youssef Al-Hilou and Vanessa Beely, for their contributions. Gaza Under Attack will be back with more. Until then, continue to keep Palestine in your hearts. Thank you.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. This is your host, Zainab. In this program, we discuss your curious questions you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. The answers are based upon the Quran and the narrations of Holy Prophet, may peace be upon him, and his purified family. Well, today in our studio, we have the pleasure to be with Brother Miqdad. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome, brother.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
So, Brother Miqdad, we have been discussing with you from the previous session that how do we train our children so that they do not get negatively influenced, and how do they create this filter within them, or how do they create that strength to rationalize things, not to take in things as such?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So in the previous session, we talked about and we defined what it means to be influenced and how to this is not necessarily a negative or a positive thing. The point over here is that is not to be adopting ideas, views, moral traits, behavior without a filter, without the ability to think about it, right?
Right.
And so we want to create children who are able to have a filter, who are able to think about things before they adopt them. And we talked about the importance and the influence of TV in this sense, and a practical point of how to deal with this. When it comes to having a positive impact in society, what we mean over there is that we're able to assist others. We're able to give to others. I want to differentiate these two, whereby coming to an attitude that we want to create in our children for ourselves as well, is that when we come to society, we should always be givers, not takers.
Okay. Right?
You find that certain people in society, when they come to community, when it comes to society, they're always takers. That means that they always want to benefit from themselves. They always look at themselves. How can I gain from this? Right? They go to mosque. I'm going to go mosque so I can gain something from it. The moment they can't gain anything from mosque, for example, the lecture is too dry. For example, my friends are not there. For example, I can't gain anything from this. Then they stop going to mosque. When they go to a community, when they go to work, when they go to interact with their friends, it's always about how can I gain from this?
Right.
And these individuals are easily influenced. These individuals, because they're only thinking about taking in, they're going to be impacted on others. And this person will not be able to think and rationalize before being impacted on others. We need to train ourselves and create within ourselves an attitude whereby we're givers, right? When we enter a society, you put your foot down in the mosque, and the first thing is, how can I be beneficial for others? How can I help others? What can I do that will be of a positive source of a benefit for others? Whether it's small, whether it's big, I'm going with this attitude. And so even if it's a situation where I'm not getting anything, as long as I can help serve the tea, I can help speak to somebody and make him feel happy, I can help financially somebody. In any way, how can I be of use and help for others? When we create this attitude, what happens is that this person now is built in such a way that wants to have an impact on others, a positive impact on others.
Right.
This is an attitude, and it's something we need to create in our children slowly, slowly, and teach them that, look, whenever you are out there, you are out there to give, not to take.
Right. So the basic concept gets clear here. The thing that we were looking for so far was how do we train our children not to get influenced negatively from others, and how to rather impact others positively is to develop a sense of giving in to the society rather than taking in. So this sense, when this gets developed, they would not be easily influenced by others, which we don't want them to get influenced by anything around them. So we'll discuss more with you, Brother Mikhtar, after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
Hey, stop! I got a favorite game!
IRIB English Radio presents A Priceless Gift to Parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm with Brother Mikhtar, and we are discussing how do we train our children not to get negatively influenced by others, rather how to have a positive impact on others.
Now, when we talk about this idea that we need to create within ourselves the attitude of being givers and not takers, you have to realize that we live in a society which is an individualist society. An individualistic society is a society where the ideology is to be takers, right? Being individualistic means that I only think about myself. The community is not important.
Right.
There is no importance in society. For example, in many movies that you watch out there, and then because of that, in the reality out there today as well, you find that when a man and a woman get together, they get together with this idea that this relationship is not necessarily noble or sacred. What's sacred or what's important over here is how much I can get from each other, right?
Oh my, yeah.
The moment I am benefiting from this relationship, we'll carry on being together. But the moment this relationship feels that I'm not getting anything out of it, for example, I don't love you anymore, or I don't find you beautiful anymore, or we don't find...
This is not working anymore
because we don't enjoy spending time together mm-hmm. anymore. Therefore, what I'll do, I'll stop this relationship, right? This relationship cannot carry on. Why? Because I'm not taking anything out of this. I'm not getting anything out of it, right? And in this individualistic ideology, what happens is that I'm always a taker, right? If I'm not taking anything, it has no value.
Mm-hmm.
This relationship is not sacred. I don't have to work for giving you something or mm-hmm. for this very important responsibility that we have towards one another in a very sacred relationship called marriage, for example. So you said the difference is very important. We live in a society which is very individualistic. It's always, even in relationship, it's always how much I can benefit, how much I can get out of this, right? The more I can get out of this, the more I'll be willing to stay and remain into work. The moment there is nothing for me in it, I'm out.
Right.
And this is an attitude that we need to change in our children. We need to teach them that, no, this is not how we are. On the contrary, we are a giver. We're in as long as we can give to others, as long as we can help others, we can be of use, then... we can remember. So this is something that is an attitude change, right?
Right.
Within, and especially now that you understand that this is how the society is, you're going against the current, basically, to be able to think like this, to be able to think that I want to be beneficial for others. Now, to create this in our children, what's one of the things that's very important is that we need to make sure that our children have a lot of confidence, a lot of self-esteem. It's only when our children have have their cup full that they are going to be able to give. See, a person who is a giver as opposed to a person who is a taker is a person whose cup is full. And what does it mean having a cup that is full? It means that they don't feel a lack within themselves. They don't feel themselves empty. They don't feel themselves that they don't have value, they don't have importance, they don't have any worth. The more a person feels worthless, valueless, not having a position in society, these individuals, their cup is empty. And when their cup is empty, they'll be more likely to be influenced by others. They're easy praise for those who want to be influencers.
Right.
Influencers are looking for people who are empty. Because people who are empty will listen, will do everything to get their cup full. But those children who grow up with their cup full, with full of confidence, with full of value and worth, right? They're very difficult to influence. They're full of giving because the cup is full.
Right. That's so beautiful. We'll discuss more with you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, "Honor your children and teach them good manners."
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm with Brother Miqdad. And we are discussing something very important. Brother Miqdad, you said it's very important to make sure for parents that the cup of the children is full. And you discussed that. They don't have that sense of emptiness. They don't take everything in. They don't get influenced by anything they see or watch. So the important question that rises over here is that how do we fill up this cup?
Something we talked about previously as well, that when we talk about ikram, when we talk about this tarbiyat that has a link with ikram and takrim, that you do ta'zim and you respect and give value and importance to your children. Children who grow up in a family that is full of love, that's full of respect, that gives children a space to communicate, a space to make decisions, a space to show and express opinions, a space where they are listened and they are accepted within the family, that their position has a value within the family, their decision plays an important role within the family. What happens is that these children, their cup gets full.
Right.
Because they see themselves, I'm worthy. When in this family, if we go on a holiday, for example, I get a say where we go on a holiday. If we're going to a restaurant, for example, my opinion about what food I like is respected. When they make a mistake, their mistake is not always corrected in a very embarrassing way that you did this wrong, and I've got a list of all the negative things that you've done in your life, I really feel that you're useless, you don't do anything, you don't clean up your room, you don't do this, you don't do this, you don't do this. These are all the mistakes that you made, these are all the gaps that you have. All of this creates a lack of worth, a lack of usefulness. So quite on the contrary, we need to create children that we encourage and make their cup full of worth, full of value.
With same ikram and tazim that you said.
What happens in that when they have this, they don't feel the need to go out to receive this.
To have that, yeah.
Exactly. So this is a very important point and something that Islam teaches about, right? There are many hadith that talk about this idea of ikram and takrim of our children, of others. And we find that the seerah of the Ahlul Bayt and seerah of the Prophet was like this as well. Whenever they would speak to individuals, whenever they would communicate with children, whenever they would interact with children, it would be with a lot of respect. The very simple thing, for example, that the Prophet, whenever he would pass on the street and he would see children, he would stop to say salam to them.
Right.
This is a sense of, like, you have, you're not like a, you know, when you pass a fly, for example, you're not going to stop for a fly, right?
Right.
Something that's not important, you don't stop. But whenever there's something important, you stop for it.
You stop
for it. So over here, when the Prophet stops to say salam, and the hadith says that even when he was in a rush to attend to something, mm-hmm. he's walking really fast. But the moment he would see children, he would stop and say salam. This giving importance to children makes their cup full.
Right. Thank you so much, Brother Miqdad, for those beautiful words of yours. I hope the parents will utilize them in their lives. Thank you so much to your listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio Anjala Session. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می‌کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
This is a short part of Imam Khomeini's speech. Clash of nature of affluence with culture of Islam. We must try to illuminate the moral conduct of affluence from this nation. If you wish that your nation should remain eternal and to realize the ideals of Islam in our society in the manner that the blessed and almighty Allah has wanted, bring down the people from that nature that is characteristic of the affluent.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله Dear audience, welcome to a new episode of Spring of the Truth from IRIB English Radio. Well, on the subject of enjoining good and forbidding evil, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi said, promoting the truth, which is the same as enjoining good and forbidding evil, is an incumbent duty on all Muslims. You know, enjoining right conduct means advice to do good and forbid indecency and to arrest or detain the doing of evil. The accomplishment of these two orders is not limited to a specific age group, and thus Luqman says to his son, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم يا بني أقم الصلاة وأمر بالمعروف وانهى عن المنكر. Oh, my dear son, establish worship and enjoin kindness and forbid iniquity. Surah Al-Luqman, verse number 17. Enjoining good is a sign of love for the faith, love for the people, and a desire for well-being of society and a sign of freedom of expression. Religious zeal, a friendly association with other people. It is a sign of awakened natural instinct and general control and presence in the society. You know, enjoining good and forbidding the evil is the reason for encouragement of those who do good, making aware those who were ignorant of this fact, being aware for the prevention of offenses and the formation of a form of societal control. Silence and indifference in the face of sin is the reason for the normalization of sinning. Those who sin find courage. We become heavy-hearted. Satan finds contentment, and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will be displeased with us. Enjoining the good and forbidding the evil must be done with knowledge, a soft heart with wisdom, and even with a level of secrecy.
يا ربنا صل على طه النبي وآله
صلى الله عليه
صل
يا
Sometimes it is ourselves that must do the talking, but rather, where we won't make any impression, our duty is not to lapse, but rather we must seek the assistance of others so that they may speak up. Even if we can just for a small period of time forbid corruption, we must forbid it, and if repetition can lead to a result, then we must repeat. Okay, that's what we had to say about the sentence of Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Depleted uranium made a spectacular entrance on the battlefront in 1991. During the first Persian Gulf War, bombs and shells made with this high-density metal annihilated Saddam Hussein's tanks. And since then, the U.S. military have regarded depleted uranium munitions as the magic weapon. For those who use it, depleted uranium is beyond reproach. But others say it is a deadly poison. So who's right and who's wrong? Many countries possess weapons based on depleted uranium, and experimentation has been rife. But the consequences for civilians and the military alike have been dramatic. Today's documentary, Depleted Uranium, a Very Presentable Killer, compares and contrasts the arguments of those who defend and attack a technology that is highly toxic. Stay with us for the first part.
It's a wonderful weapon. Depleted uranium is a very dense, hard metal. And you put it on the end of a bullet or you put it on the end of a shell and it'll go through a tank and go through the second tank. I mean, it's wonderful from a military standpoint.
Based on the fact that certain armies around the world are developing new armor plating capabilities, which can't be pierced other than by depleted uranium munitions, it's quite normal to conserve a high-level operational capability that the French army envisages equipping its Leclerc tanks with this type of munitions.
I was trying to say, hey, guys, you may be creating a problem. I have been very careful not to accuse because... You know, j'accuse is a pretty strong thing to say to somebody.
My name is Jacques Charmelot. I've been a journalist for 30 years. I've covered conflicts in Africa, Iran, Lebanon, Iraq, and in the Balkans. And I've worked in Washington, a secret and powerful city. On July the 4th, 2012, I'm in America's federal capital. I'm in the crowd attending the Independence Day parade. But my thoughts are elsewhere. I'm back from a battleground that the American soldiers have just left, Iraq. Barack Obama has put an end to more than 20 years of war-torn confrontation between the US and this distant country. But what I saw there is indelibly etched on my memory. Depleted uranium begins in Iraq. Iraq has been subjected to more than 50 years of revolutions, dictatorships, and wars. And it's trying with all its might to be reborn. But its poisoned past weighs heavy on the fate of 30 million Iraqi citizens. My investigation begins in Basra, a huge port caught between Iran, Kuwait, and Saudi Arabia. In February 1991, it is at the heart of the international offensive to drive Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait. Iraqi tanks want to leave the small emirate, but American planes, masters of guise, are waiting for them. I head for the scene of the Iraqi rout.
I took part in the war in Kuwait against the American forces.
Could you tell us about leaving Kuwait? How it happened for you?
I fought in the war up to the very end until the Iraqi army retreated, but it wasn't so much a retreat as every man for himself. The road was exposed and the planes bombarded our military forces. That was the situation with our tanks. The road was open and straight, and it was very easy for the Americans to bomb our tanks. It was this, the road of death.
The final battle in the war lasted just 10 hours. Hundreds of tanks and vehicles were blown into shreds and abandoned in the desert. Much later, an official American document explains why the success was so devastating. On the road of death, American pilots used a newcomer to their weaponry arsenal. They fired thousands of rounds containing at least 320 tons of depleted uranium. The rounds are equipped with a depleted uranium arrowhead penetrator, which can pierce any armor plating. They catch fire on impact, reaching over 1,000 degrees, igniting the target and emitting a cloud of fine dust. They are real tank killers. Four countries are the main producers: the United States, Russia, China, and France. Natural uranium is used in numerous countries. Once enriched, it becomes highly radioactive and is used in atomic weapons and nuclear power stations. The residue of the enrichment process is called depleted uranium. It is weakly radioactive, but is not degradable. It has to be securely stored or recycled. 50,000 tons are produced around the world every year. In Basra, depleted uranium is accused of leaving a terrible legacy. I head for the city's central hospital.
Are you being treated?
Yes, I'm still being treated. Until God takes my soul. They diagnosed cancer in my pancreas and then my liver. You know, the countries that started the wars don't come to help us. They poured their poison on us and then they went away.
In 1991, the first Gulf War started, and at that time I was here on a duty at night duty, when the airplanes, fighters and bombs. After that, by many years, 3 or 4 years, we start to see many cases of cancer, particularly in this hospital. If we compare it to the 80s or 90s, we found there is an increase of, say, fourfold. 1996, somebody came here with a delegation, escorting a delegation. He's from the security, and he knows about the problem. And he told me, "Doctor, you know that we are under the effects of depleted uranium, which is used by the American." Yeah, he just whispered into my ear that we got this problem. And so we start to have a link between the use of depleted uranium and the increased cancer rates. You know, now we have what we call a cancer phobia here among people. Everybody who got a mass, they think that we got a cancer.
Even before Dr. Jawad Al-Ali learnt about the dangers of depleted uranium, in 1995, the Americans produced a film alerting its own soldiers to the risks involved with the heavy metal.
Battlefields and fighting are by nature hazardous to your health. Some hazards are easy to identify and well understood. Soldiers recognize the serious hazards presented by incoming artillery shells and bullets and take appropriate actions. However, some lesser hazards from new technological applications are not so well known and recognized. One of these newer applications is the use of depleted uranium in munitions and equipment armor.
The film fixes 3 safety rules for dealing with potential depleted uranium contamination. Get away as far as possible, as quickly as possible, and avoid any exposure to the skin. 3 rules that were impossible to respect in Basra. I discover one of the tank cemeteries that abound throughout the city. There are thousands of tons of debris, some of which contaminated by depleted uranium dust, have been accessible to the population here for 20 years. I'll ask the head of the Environment Ministry why such dangerous metal wasn't removed to safety.
After 1991, we had a full report on the sites and their effects. There was no department to deal with it. Every time we found a piece of contaminated metal, we identified it with a red or yellow tag. Before 2003, we put a notice, "Danger, contaminated fragment, do not approach." Shortly after, we'd return to the same place and the notices would have disappeared and we'd find them somewhere else. Even if we deemed it important at the time, it was only relatively important, as the situation was very complex and local authorities had other concerns. Why did the Americans from 2003 and even since 1991 not remove or displace the metal waste? They did nothing at the time. The likely reason, in my view, is that they hadn't yet measured the effects of using this weaponry. They wanted to see the results and the effects after 5, 10, and 15 years, etc. God will decide. But the munitions they used against us will have effects on our children, our grandchildren, and our great-grandchildren for generations to come, probably until the end of time.
During the invasion of Kuwait, Paris was a faithful ally of the USA, and French troops played a crucial role.
Très bien, à tout de suite.
I contact journalist Marie-Claude Dubin, who was at the front line.
There was a tank which looked all burnt up. And I said, can I go inside? It's not mine. No, it's not mine. You can go in. I raised up clouds of dust, and I never imagined that the ashes were mixed with depleted uranium dust.
What illness are you suffering from?
An autoimmune disease. I've been told it attacks the nerves, muscles, the thyroid, plus certain neurocognitive problems, neuromuscular lesions.
To get a clearer picture of what happened to Marie-Claude Dubin and to patients in the Basra Hospital, I go to Valence to see a scientist. For years, Roland Desbordes has been speaking out against the risks of depleted uranium. He's the president of CRIRAD.
We know that depleted uranium is pyrophoric, which means that it ignites spontaneously in the air, with the oxygen in the air. A flameless combustion, but with oxidization, producing uranium oxide, which is an extremely fine dust that's released into the air. You can then be contaminated internally, either through inhalation, if you're not wearing a mask, or by ingestion, because it'll be on your fingers. The uranium combines many risks, but why? Because it's an alpha emitter, and alpha radiation is what causes the most internal damage. Secondly, because it's a heavy metal, and we retain it. It metabolizes within the organism for many long years. For it to lose half its radioactivity, it takes 4.5 billion years.
4.5 billion years is the same age as planet Earth. These concerns over the harmful effects of depleted uranium dust are shared by official scientific bodies.
The problem is, in the case of internal contamination, either you ingest it because you're in a contaminated environment and it can be found in the water and in food, or you inhale and the particles of depleted uranium reach your lungs. There are two phases to this. Firstly, the uranium particles have to be dissolved to get into the blood, and once they're in the bloodstream, they'll be distributed among the various organs. Once in the organs, either it builds up or it doesn't.
We often refer to the case of the Iraqi children who play in the tanks that were destroyed and who collect the scrap metal and cut it up, or housewives who sometimes recycle the metal to make pots that they'll subsequently cook in. Do you think there's a risk?
There are potential effects, especially if there's repeated exposure, even if it's not chronic. And this will be the case. Children come to play, water is cooked in the pots. With ingestion, with repeated administration within the body, even if you only have weak doses, the fact of accumulating the various doses can ultimately have an effect on health.
Clearly, the depleted uranium dust falls down, and it settles.
Yes. Once it falls, obviously the ground will be contaminated. Afterwards, it depends on how this contamination comes about, if it's very localized or not, and whether it's in towns or in fields which will be cultivated. So there will definitely be a contamination of the environment.
Things are becoming clearer to me, and more worrying. The depleted uranium particles are dangerous for health and for nature. The career of depleted uranium munitions began in Iraq, but it continued in the heart of Europe, just a few hours by air from capital cities like Paris, Rome, and Berlin. I walk among the graves in the Jewish cemetery in Sarajevo. It was from here that Serbian snipers kept the besieged city locked down. The journalists, who like myself, came to cover the conflict, often found themselves behind the yellow walls of the Holiday Inn. In 1992, divisions in Yugoslavia forced Bosnia into a war. In April, the inhabitants of Sarajevo were trapped. The UN launched an impossible mission to reconcile Muslims, Serbs, and Croats. But the war dragged on, and in 1995, NATO intervened. NATO planes, mostly American, bombed the Serbs, who were forced to make peace. The Sniper Alley tramway takes me to Hadići, a suburb on the outskirts of Sarajevo. I enter a ruined factory, a key element in the Serbs' military industry. Tanks and cannons were repaired here. NATO planes attacked the Hadići factory seven times in September 1995. And fired more than 4,000 depleted uranium shells. When peace was reinstated, many Serbs from Hadići moved to Bratunac, a Serbian republic town in eastern Bosnia. They went there to live and also to die. Nedeljko Zelenović is a journalist and a witness. He has investigated the NATO bombings. His father, uncle, cousins, and dozens of friends worked in the Hadići factory.
All the workers who worked on the assembly lines at the time, who were caught in the fighting, and later at the time I was following events, they all died from various forms of cancer. In 1996, the population of Bratunac was between 20 and 22,000 people. And less than 5% of them came from Hadići. That year, in 1996, 154 people were buried in the Bratunac Municipal Cemetery. 3% of them came from Hadići. But in 2000, 105 people were buried in Bratunac, and 50% of them came from Hadići. I have a few names if you're interested.
Jerić Budimir, Andrić Drago, Mastilo Dušan, Banduka Milinko, Banduka Danilo, Aleksić Nenad, Makajić Simo, Stanojević Relja, Puša Ramomir, Turuntaš Ljubica, Lavušić Gospod, Udović.
What did your son die of?
He was diagnosed with leukemia. I asked what it was caused by. And they told me it was due to depleted uranium.
Mehmed Telalevich is a Muslim. During the war, he fled Hadići, driven out by the Serbs. In 1996, he returned home, close to the ruins of the arms factory. He found his house blown apart by bombs. Mehmed rebuilt it, not suspecting that the land around it had been contaminated by poisonous dust.
We were never told. Nobody ever said anything. The public at large can't even be aware of it, as this disease is really a lottery. You put up with it, you fight it, and you might live or die. I know at least 10 people here, all young, aged between 35 and 40. They all have a cancer.
Mehmet tells me that he discovered he had colon cancer in 2004. He's taken chemotherapy and is now in remission. But the news is not good. The latest tests revealed that his prostate is four times bigger than normal. He has blood in his urine.
I've become fragile. Before, I could take normal showers. But now I have to have very, very hot showers. I have to wear leggings. I'm cold all the time. I'm delicate. My blood is anemic. I've no immunity.
Are you sure all this is because of the factory?
Oh, yes, I'm 100% certain. There are no other diseases here apart from cancer.